Good morning, everybody. I'm Capitol correspondent Tim Skubick, sitting in for Mark Bayshore, who is somewhere warm. And we are not warm, are we? Rick Pluta from Michigan Public Radio and Bill Ballinger from Inside Michigan Politics. As you know, each month at this time, we sit down and talk about what happened in the month, newsworthy. Give me your lead. It's a little chilly.
I mean, we're not outside.
So. You know, I feel like we're doing David Letterman, you know, 32 degrees, just to, you know, keep the juices going. Give me your lead story for February. What was the top story, Ricky?
For me, it's Michigan's same-sex marriage ban going on trial in Detroit.
All right. That's not the right answer, Billy. That's a good try, though.
Can I get a consolation
you
prize?
You do.
Early skirmishes over the state budget. Particularly involving transportation.
Wrong again, guys. It's snow removal.
Well, transportation.
Well, okay. Yeah, all right. Well, what are they doing on transportation? Is there going to be more money for snow removal and potholes right like now?
Yes. And the problem for one tough nerd is that...
that would be the governor for people who just moved from Ohio.
Is that whether they put 100 and something million or 200 and something million into it, what that does is that's a stopgap. That deals with the problems or some of the problems that have been created by this ferocious winter. But that'll buy some salt, fill some potholes, cover some overtime. But it won't deal with the pressing long-term structural needs of the system. And as soon as the governor gives that away, then that also eliminates the pressure to go for the big money, which is $1.2 billion.
Billy, what's your take on this?
Well, I think what Rick said is absolutely correct. The key thing right now is the legislature, which has kind of dismissed the governor's entreaties to come up with $1.2 billion a year for 10 years, now is in a panic over snow removal and potholes and is fighting between the House and Senate on how much to give to this. And the governor's saying, wait, where was all this enthusiasm?
Well, he's kind of, except
when I needed you.
Except he's trying to have it both ways. That you know, he's on board with some sort of, you know, emergency,
but he
you
hasn't
know,
given
potholes.
Number yet.
He has not.
How long does
We're
it take to add up 4 and 4 and come up with a million? Okay, yeah. I mean, come on.
He claims he's coming up with new figures now.
New numbers.
Yeah.
Well,
actually,
they will do something in the short term. We agree
yes,
on that.
Yes.
Okay.
The only question is how much.
Well, because they can,
does that slide over into broader transportation funding?
And they will do that because they can do it without having to squeeze taxpayers for more.
Well, look, we have a soundbite here we want to play. The growing despair of Michigan roads became much of an issue, as we just discussed here in February. Here's Denise Donahue, director of the County Road Association, who would love to get her hands on more money. Please.
Our road agencies need bigger budgets all the way around. All we're talking about is clearing the snow. When all the folks are telling me when the pothole season occurs in late March or April, the frost is very, very deep in the ground. We're going to see more potholes and chunks being tossed up onto the pavement than we've seen in a long time.
Blah, blah, blah. It's the same old story from the roller
block. And not just, and not from the ground up, but also, you know, from the top down, that when we start seeing pieces falling off bridges.
Well, that's the point. The governor made the point this in the Chamber of Commerce. Now, talk about bad money after bad money. They're going to do billboards, try to convince lawmakers to put money. Bill, please. Are billboards going to turn votes around in this legislature?
No.
Billboards worked so well in the Medicaid expansion.
Yes, in the Medicaid thing, right.
Really, and this is a campaign year, so legislators are very reluctant to get into stuff like this, raising taxes, fees, doing major transportation funding restructuring. But the bottom line is legislators love to give money to people when the population thinks they need it in an emergency. And this is an emergency.
Yeah.
And it's going to get worse. The potholes are going to proliferate in the next 2 months.
The governor said yesterday, if you drive on the freeway system and you go under or over eight bridges, one of them is in disrepair. And he said, now we don't have to close them down.
He said, if you go over eight bridges, then at least one of them statistically is what's called structurally deficient, which does not mean dangerous, but it's on the road to dangerous.
Tim, I call that a veiled threat.
One word, Minnesota.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember Minnesota? Yes. How many years ago was that?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
oh,
where
that
the
was
bridge
about 5 years
collapsed. I mean, that
ago.
Was an ugly sight. Yeah. You don't want that happening in Michigan on anybody's watch.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
All right, what else was big in February, Billy?
Oh, I mean, I think the usual, the tax cut. Are we going to have a tax cut? Or are we going to have a homestead tax credit?
Or both.
or both. You know, I'm talking about in Lansing. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on, obviously, with bankruptcy down in Detroit.
Yep.
Rick has got his own interest
I'm gonna
in,
let him get
in
to that
gay
eventually.
Marriage.
I will.
But here in Lansing, I think because the governor comes out with his budget in February and there's all the early skirmishing, I think that's what it's really been about.
The homestead exemption as proposed by the governor did not open to rave reviews. Why?
Well, because it doesn't fit with the Republican mantra on tax cutting, which is that it should be across the board so that the people who pay the most get the most relief.
That would be the rich.
And what the governor is saying is, you know what, we've only got so much money to put into this. And really, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot. So let's do it where it will make a difference, where people will notice it and use it.
There he goes being a non-career politician.
I don't know that it's a bad political move either.
Well, it does target the tax relief at people that supposedly need it. And as he has said,
working class independent voters.
Rich people are not calling me up and saying they want a tax break.
Remember, the difference between the governor who is running for reelection is he's running statewide.
Right.
Legislators who are running for reelection are running in districts drawn primarily to benefit Republicans. And the dynamic, the political dynamics there are
quite
different.
Neither the twain shall meet. There will be something.
I think there will be something. But again, we haven't mentioned what the governor's proposing is pretty hard to explain to people. Mm-hmm. And it covers a relatively small number of people.
1.3 million?
Well, it's not 10 million, like the Republicans would make it broader and so forth. So that is the good part of the Republican legislator's argument. But, you know, for the governor, in terms of the image of that he wants to create going into a reelection bid, that he's trying to help the people who need it most, lower income people, his proposal is the more intelligent suggestion.
Mm-hmm. And when he gets hammered by the Democrats, as he already is, as, you know, being against the working class, he can go, hey, wait a second, you know, look at this tax proposal. What is this about except for, you know, helping hard working class taxpayers with their home taxes?
And don't forget, I also helped the same group of people with Medicaid expansion. Mm. So it's beginning to add up on
his
side.
The same sort of thing.
Yeah. All right. Talk about the gay marriage court case.
Oh, well, you know, this has been long anticipated, a couple of years in the making, that finally Michigan's same-sex marriage ban, the constitutional amendment approved 10 years ago by voters, is on trial in Detroit as potentially a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And it's getting a lot of attention, although not as much attention as it seemed to be getting even, you know, as recently as this summer, in part because federal judges in other states have been knocking down same-sex
left
marriage
and right.
bans.
In fact, really, one happened in Texas yesterday. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that's number four since the Doma
decision.
The
popular wisdom is this judge is going to side with the LGBT community. Is that the buzz in the courtroom?
I mean, everyone seems to think that's his predisposition, although every time he's had the opportunity to pull the trigger on it, you know, he's said, wait, one more thing. And what makes this distinctive is that from some of these other cases is this is where not just Michigan's same-sex marriage ban is on trial, but all the research surrounding that.
Well, this is a trial on the data.
This is a trial on the data, on the studies, on the methods and you know, the size of the samples and where they've drawn them from.
On the issue of, are kids okay with gay parents?
And what the plaintiffs, April DeBoer and Jane Rouse and the ACL want to do is they want to go and take all of that research. They say it's junk science, conclusion-based reasoning, and they want to shred it, bury it, and salt the earth so that it cannot be used again as a legitimate claim on the legitimacy of same-sex marriage.
Here's the problem for the judge. The people in Michigan have spoken to this.
Exactly.
In 2004.
Yeah, this is a big problem. Judges seem to be in a rush all over the country to overturn traditional marriage by judicial fiat. Where they've had votes in the country, obviously traditional marriage, at least until the last 18 months, has been upheld. we should probably be deciding these very controversial emotional issues in the legislature by public debate, in votes. We've gotten into a lot of trouble on abortion because of Roe v. Wade, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision. It was never allowed to be settled in the states or nationally. I think this is another instance.
No, wait a minute. There's no motivation in this Republican legislature to revisit this issue. This is a done deal for them. The only folks that want to revisit it are the D's, and they don't have the votes
then,
to revisit
well,
it.
Then the Democrats and the people who want gay marriage should put it on the ballot again, have a revote in 2016. And in fact, they are talking about doing that. Is what should be done, not have a judge come in and say, you know something, for 200 years, traditional marriage was okay, but all of a sudden I find something wrong with it, and it's illegal.
Well, times change.
There are two things about that, though. And one of them is that this certainly would not happen if we were not seeing a dramatic shift in public opinion on this. Now, public opinion surveys, it is true, it is not election, but it does seem to be creating cover we won't know until an election happens.
Exactly.
So,
precisely my point.
But the part of the claim here is that DeBoer and Rouse are saying, you know what though, that marriage is a fundamental right. It is not something that can or should be legislated. It is not something that can or should be voted on by the public, just like any other civil rights.
So it should not be settled by judges.
That is basically the argument.
Well, that's why we do have a court
system. It should be taken off the table.
And I'm saying it's probably resulting in diminished respect for our courts, which you've seen.
Has anybody in the court case raised the argument that gay marriage and gay adoption somehow does something to traditional marriage, or have they given up that?
I have not seen or heard that yet. Really, the argument, and most of it is based around the welfare of children. Sure. Remember, this started as an adoption rights case.
Right.
So, you know, not as much that. What the state is arguing is that, and these are nuanced legal arguments, that a male, female, biological parents of the children are the, quote, optimal situation for children. Therefore, it was rational for voters to approve it. It wasn't a ridiculous decision. And if it's going to be changed, then it should be changed by voters. That's the state's argument.
When do we hear from the judge?
This trial is supposed to go through the end of next week. There's no hard end date.
Right.
And we don't know whether he'll rule from the bench or we'll have to wait.
Let's turn the page. The governor got style points for recommending $350 million to help the pensioners in Detroit under bankruptcy. How's he doing on selling that, William?
That remains to be seen.
That is an understatement. Please.
Well, let's put it this way. The Democrats want to support it, and I think key Republican leaders in the legislature want to support
it.
But the majority of the Republicans in the House and Senate do not, because there is always reluctance to give money to Detroit to bail it out for what
this is not a bailout, the governor says.
This is not a bailout. They look at it and define it. And so I think it really is going to come down to, are there strings attached?
Yes. Randy Richardson had a great line. He says, not strings, ropes.
Ropes, okay.
Ropes.
Okay, and are they tenable? Are they sellable? Will they make legislators say, okay, we can accept that? You know, obviously it would be very helpful to the emergency manager and the powers to be in Detroit if they could make this happen, but it is a tough sell.
Mm-hmm. It is. And you know, as you know, Democrats are also saying that they may be inclined, but they're saying don't assume out of the gate that we're on board with this,
that
we may have our own strings in exchange for supporting this. But really, and the governor's best sales pitch is not really a great one, because this is the least worst option, that this $350 million will be used to forestall worse things from happening, like having to sell, you know, the artwork in the DIA.
But there you go again, applying logic to the political process. If you looked
the
at this logic.
The political process has its own logic. It's just very.
can you give me an example of the last time it applied?
Please,
we have a half hour show. Fill it.
Why does a Republican from Kalkaska care passionately about whether or not Detroit has to sell works of art in order to meet its obligations.
I mean that's
the logic. That you've got to go back and sell that to.
Well, you've got to go back. The logic is pay me now or pay me more later. Okay, if Detroit doesn't get out of this thing, we got to help them now so that the bill will be. Does that resonate?
That's the governor's argument, and it's working just as well here as it is with road funding.
Exactly, and he doesn't have the votes to do this.
Legislators tend to believe they'll never have to pay.
Well, at least they hope they don't, right? Minimum wage.
That's the problem, is that the legislature does handle the state's finances just like we handle our family's finances.
Yeah, and some of us do it well and some of us don't, but we won't go there. Minimum wage, this is going to be on the ballot?
It looks like for sure it will be on the ballot. The real question is whether the legislature and or the governor decide, Monty Hall, let's make a deal here. It's going on the ballot, so let's make it a little less onerous on the business community than it would be if it's voted in by the people and they pass a bill.
As we look at this governor's race, this appears at this early read, and it is early, that this is one of the only things that Mark Schauer has to go out and beat the drum on, or is there something else?
Well, you know, they're using the extending the income tax to pensions. You know, now it's the seniors tax that there's
the cuts
this
to education
over school funding.
There's that word, NIF9. I love it. You get the prize.
But you know, this does seem to be sort of, you know, an emblematic issue that Mark Schauer and Democrats can use, and all the way up and down the ballot. This is a federal issue.
Yep.
This is a state issue. In order to sort
let,
of
let me pick
make
up on,
the,
and okay. Thank you for reminding me on this. There are conflicting schools of thought on whether the cuts to education and the pension tax on senior are actually working. Remember, we had on the show Eric Nesbitt last week, who says, "Go ahead, Democrats, continue to play that song because it doesn't work." And we had the guy Brandon Dillon, who said, "Yeah, it's working."
These are the respective Republican
for
and
the
Democratic
House and Senate
House
campaigns.
Caucus
so
campaigns
is it working? Does this resonate
well,
with voters?
Well, I think polls show that among the general public right now, it is working. So I think Dillon is right and Nesbitt is wrong. And that's largely because the Republicans in the legislature have done a poor job of explaining whether they actually have cut funding for education.
To underscore
the last
how
years.
This is important, the Snyder people asked an attorney to ask the TV stations to take off the ad where Mr. Schauer says he cut education by $1 billion. Now, of course, they didn't, but that was a clear indication that they are concerned.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, it's become one of those standard campaign tactics, which is, you know, go legal on them. And
threaten your license. Did you catch the line in the lights? May impact your license with the
FCC. And
I
think that, you know, even the broadcasters who are very protective of that have nevertheless become kind of sanguine about it. Like, yeah, you know, been there, done that. We know how this turns out.
You know what? Let me put this on the table. One word makes a difference. Remember in the race for governor between DeVos and Granholm, the one word that was critical was he shipped jobs to China. Mm-hmm. Now the key word is cut. The governor cut education. Wouldn't it be fascinating if this race came down to who believes what that word cut means?
Well, it would be, and it would be instructive if people have learned their lesson and they can really detect the truth. You had the state budget director outgoing this weekend on TV, and he'll tell people that the reason Michigan has increased its funding on education is if you count pension benefits, because that's what the state has done.
Yep.
Come in and all the Democrats are talking about is per pupil foundation grant funding.
And the
that's
poor
what they're
people,
talking
their
about.
Their eyes are glazing. This is a complicated
debate. But one is also a long-term benefit, and the other is a, you know, here's what happened, you know, right now in this brief window.
Actual increase right now. The state has increased.
Bill Ballinger, Inside Michigan Politics, for Ricky Pluto from Michigan Public Radio. Always good to see you guys. Enjoy the rest of the spring.
Mm-hmm. Going skiing.
Spring.
Spring. In my head. I'm Tim Skubikin for Mark Bayshore. And let's listen to a little music. Can we play that kind of funky music on public radio? Can we play funky music like that? I hope so. Hey, that's good stuff. Hi, Tim Skubik in for Mark Bayshore, who's enjoying some sunshine. And we hope you're enjoying our program this morning here on Current State. Jim Harrison is one of Michigan's most well-known literary voices. You've heard his name for years. Current State contributor Scott Southard has his take on a recently published collection of the famed author's novellas, which center around his longtime character in Alter Ego. What was this guy's name? Brown Dog.
In Michigan, one of the things we all accept are the supposed differences between the Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula. The stereotypes haunt the residents of both regions. Rural versus urban. Those who are stressed versus those who are relaxed. Those happy with money versus those happy in long underwear. Heck, the Upers sometimes even talk differently. And one thing the Upper Peninsula has that the Lower Peninsula could never hope to have is its own literary genre. Honestly, any story that happens in our normal Lower Peninsula could happen in any state in the Midwest. You take out the city names and it might as well be set in Ohio. But a story set in the UP is a unique entity unto itself. The characters, the pace, the trials, the almost magical realism of the environment. Well, that's UP Lit. One of the godfathers of this unique genre is Michigan notable book author Jim Harrison. Yes, Mr. Harrison was born in Grayling, Michigan, and doesn't even live in our state anymore, but the UP is still represented in much of his writing, including his new collection of novellas called Brown Dog. For those new to Harrison's work, Brown Dog, or BD as his friends call him, is Harrison's everyman character, an adult Huck Finn-like soul, perfectly happy to drink a six-pack in the morning, live alone in a cabin, and spend an entire day fishing. He does occasional odd jobs, doesn't have a social security number, and women strangely find him irresistible. Harrison has been writing about Brown Dog for over 20 years, and in this collection, all of his novellas on this very UP Lit character are finally put together. Over the course of these tales, we see BD betray his Native American ancestors, run away to Los Angeles, return and become a parent, travel with an Indian rock band, and then retire with his lesbian wife. Sadly, for me, reading this collection felt like a missed opportunity. With a little time and energy, these novellas could have been reworked and edited into one novel. Instead, a decision was made not to do that, and the shift from novella to novella can feel a little jarring, since we are jumping around, sometimes by years, from when each were written. A better way to describe this book is to think of it like a box set for a TV show, and just like watching TV episodes back to back in a marathon, you can get frustrated by recaps of past events you just experienced and reintroductions of characters that feel unnecessary, not to mention wonder about characters that Harrison just decided to keep out of the later stories. Another problem with a collection like this is that not all of the episodes are equal. While there is almost a mad glee in Harrison's writing in the first novella, by the last, you feel as tired as Harrison seems to feel with the character as he limps like an old dog to the last page. The BD at the end is definitely not the same as the character we meet at the beginning. Time and age have changed him, leaving him and the stories feeling more like a bland shell of his past glory. Harrison's Brown Dog feels more like a goodbye than a hello. It's a book for Jim Harrison fans, not for those who want to discover his writing. And as much as I may have complained about this book, the fact is, a character like BD could only come from a land like the Upper Peninsula, making him a unique part of our own local literary movement. Something new is emerging from the Upper Peninsula, and long underwear is not necessary. For Current State, this is Scott Southern.
Thank you, Scott. Scott's the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanford and The Case of Dangerous Dare. Sounds like interesting stuff. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com, his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. I'm Tim Skubik, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. and enjoying this program. Hope you are too, right here on WKAR, Current State. We all know people in our community we feel are extraordinary for their memorable life experiences or their sacrifices, maybe for their successes or even their service, and for the insights that come from those experiences. Getting better acquainted with extraordinary people is the focus of Current State's ongoing series, Voices of Experience. So far, we've heard from Frank Kelly, I think he used to be the Attorney General, and George Perlis, who used to be something what we don't care anymore. And WKR's Melissa Benmark has our next interview.
Yeah, Rabbi Morton Hoffman was the head of Congregation Shari Zedek from 1983 until 2000, and then he kind of had a second. He became unretired and then re-retired a little while there. Over the course of his life as rabbi, he served congregations in California, Israel, Florida, and Michigan. He also served as an army chaplain in Japan. His life experience spans the Great Depression to the changes happening in American Judaism then and now. And I had a real great time speaking with Rabbi Hoffman last fall at his home in East Lansing. We started out with his early years in Cleveland, Ohio.
My parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe, and came here without two dimes to rub together. We came here also just in time for the Great Depression. I was the last of five children. Four siblings of mine were born in Eastern Europe. I was the only one born here in the United States. And my mother used to call me her Yankee Doodle. We got through the Depression somehow. I remember my parents sitting on the couch and the welfare worker coming to interview them. And that was the first time I ever saw them cry, hold hands and cry. And it scared the heck out of me. I thought that we were going to have to split up our family and worse. My father was able to bring home enough chickens. He was a ritual slaughterer. They are called by the name Shochet. And there was always some part of the chicken that my mother was able to turn into a delicacy. She was a fantastic cook. So from the point of view of the Depression, etc., we didn't have much, but we never starved. I went to public schools. I was able to do pretty well in public schools because, after all, English was my first language. And we were able to get through the public school system in Cleveland, Ohio, where I was born, with enough success so that I was able to go to college, to Western Reserve University, which is now Case Western Reserve University.
So then what influenced you to become a rabbi?
Oh, it was inevitable. My father was a very learned man. I learned the Hebrew alphabet on his knee. When I went to public school, I always also went to Hebrew school. When I got to the upper grades, I was actually sent to New York to a rabbinical school by my parents. I don't know whether they just wanted to get rid of me or whether they really wanted me to become a rabbi, but it was interesting. Just as my parents, who were extremely Orthodox, were trying to get me to become an Orthodox rabbi. I was becoming Americanized. And in my development as an American citizen, I began questioning the old orthodoxy of Eastern Europe. So my parents and I had a good deal of friction, shall we say, as I grew more American, less orthodox, more willing to, in their eyes, violate the Sabbath, and they looked upon me as their last best hope. My brothers and sisters, all of them had become Americanized. Why shouldn't I? And so I became a Reform rabbi, not an Orthodox rabbi.
So you were in Cleveland, then you were an army chaplain, where?
For about 5 months, I was an army chaplain in Fort Riley, Kansas. And for a year and a half, I was a chaplain in Japan. The Korean War had just ended. What a nice coincidence. The day I was sworn in as chaplain first lieutenant, that very day we were in New York at Fort Slocum getting our chaplaincy training. We went into New York City, I recall. It was a weekend, so we had no classes at Fort Slocum. But the electronic news was coming loud and clear around the New York Times building. And sure enough, there it said that the ceasefire had been settled on at Panmunjom in North Korea. And yeah, that was the very day I was sworn in. That was as close as I came to combat, serving in Japan, a most beautiful country. And I got there just in time for my first cherry blossom festival. Jumping ahead later on, when I got married, my wife had heard me talk about Japanese culture and the beauty of the land itself. She had heard me speak about it so often that she made me take her to Japan in 1967, I believe it was. I went there as a temporary brigadier general in the Army Chaplain Corps because they needed someone to conduct Passover services. And so they gave me the opportunity to do that. And my wife was happy and satisfied. And I was delighted to have another opportunity to visit old friends that I had made in Japan.
In about 1970, you made Aliyah, you went to Israel. What was that like at that time?
Not in about 1970, exactly in 1970. That was interesting. My wife was, she passed away just 4 months ago, and life hasn't been the same, I might add. But anyway, she was an Israeli. Israelis love to travel because they have a very small country and they all want to see what the rest of the world is like. And so I married her. Gorgeous. I fell in love with her at first sight. And I loved her so much that I was willing to make her a promise. I promised her when we got married that we would go to Israel one day to try to live, to try to make it there. And that's what we did in 1970 after, let's see, we were married in 1959, so approximately 11 years into our marriage, if my math is correct, we went to Israel with three children. And the fourth child was born in Israel. Well, we lived in Israel for 4 years and 2 months. And then my savings ran out. Yeah, running out of your savings is no fun. We tried hard. I worked at two jobs. But we did not make a go of it. And we came back to California. Oh, yes, I had started my rabbinical career as a civilian after I got out of the Army chaplaincy. I spent 2 years in Philadelphia, and then the next 13 years in California, in a wonderfully beautiful place called Marin County, San Rafael. I was the chief rabbi of San Rafael, because I was the only rabbi in San Rafael. So, but it was a great experience. I built a congregation there, Congregation Rodef Shalom. Rodef Shalom means seeking peace. So we built that congregation from scratch. When I got there, there were something like 60 or 70 members who were joining together to form a congregation. And I'm proud to say that when I left there to go to Israel, it was a congregation of 350 families. And so we had a great success there. And once again, I seemed to gravitate to very beautiful places. And I'm not sorry about that. The rabbinate has done nicely by me. It's given me the most beautiful places in which to work, including East Lansing, Michigan, which I love. I've spent how many years here? I got here in 1983, and I've been here for 30 years now. It's hard to imagine how time flies, but yes, I've been here for 30 years, and I wouldn't have stayed here that long if I didn't like it very much.
So you come from building a congregation in California to East Lansing, Michigan, that does not have an especially large Jewish population. You must have been doing some building here as well.
One doesn't do a lot of building in a community such as this. It's fairly stable. When I got here, there were about 280 families, and right now I'm told that it still has 280 families, or close to it. The numbers haven't changed. And now we have a whole new demographic. It's a whole new bunch of people. Many of my contemporaries have died off, I'm sorry to say. Most of them have become octogenarians, as have I. And it's good that we are able to serve a whole new bunch.
In your lifetime, religion in general has gone through a lot of changes. What changes do you think have been positive? What do you think has been negative?
The first thing I should note is that all the men come to the synagogue in jeans. In jeans, whereas when I first got here, everybody dressed up in a suit and a tie. Dress is now much less elaborate and much more relaxed. We went through a period of time when people did not come to services. They were members, but they didn't come to services very often. That was the valley. But lately, I have to say that they're beginning to come back. I think I know why, but there are several theories about that.
I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are as to why people are coming back.
They're coming back because of the instability of their lives. The American economy, I need not tell you, has gone through quite a few years of ups and downs, and the downs definitely are the things that I think bring them back. They pray that their families shall remain together, and I think that they look upon prayer as something that will help them get through their troubles if they are in economic trouble. Also, I need to say, the congregation has also become more flexible. The congregation now has no need for just prayer services. The congregation is serving more and more as a gathering place for people who need one another. And the congregation supplies that need. Now, we serve young families much more adequately than we did in the past, and I have to give credit to the current rabbi, who is a woman. She's a fine rabbi by the name of Amy Bigman, and she's been alert to the changing demographics and has built programs in accordance with those needs.
What do you think are the challenges facing Judaism in the next 50 years, say?
There has been this change. Once upon a time, when I got here 30 years ago, the families that belonged to the congregation were all Jewish. That is to say that the man and the woman who had decided to get married, the mother and the father of a family, would usually both be Jewish. There now has developed a pattern of intermarriage where more Jews and Christians and even non-Christians, they are intermarrying in larger numbers than ever. And that poses new challenges. I can say to you that these intermarried couples are frequently the most active couples that we have. The Jewish partner in the marriage remains faithful to his religion or her religion, and the non-Jewish partner usually converts to Judaism. Not always, but most do. And once they are converted, I have to say, they become so active. They want, whether it's because they want to prove to their new Jewish in-laws that they are genuine in their desire to be active Jews, or whether it's because they came from a background where they always went to church and never skipped a Sunday. I have to say that our folks frequently skipped the Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath. They're the less active in these intermarried partners. Their wives, who have converted, are very often the most active, and they drag their husbands or their wives to the synagogue. They follow the pattern of active involvement in the church to which they had belonged. They transfer it to the synagogue, and the synagogues now have better attendance than they had when I first came here. Isn't that interesting?
If I may ask you what your age is?
I am 86 and a half.
And looking back over those 86 years, what do you feel matters most to you, and what do you think overall matters most in life?
In life? Oh, that's a big question, a real big question. What matters most in life is being able to grow up with stability, with good homes and families. I believe that religion, whether it's Judaism or any other religion, plays a great role in that. So the ability to go through all of the ups and downs, all of the changes that life offers without self-destruction. And unfortunately, we have a drug culture that enables many young people to choose to make the wrong choices, to choose poorly. When I address a bar mitzvah student or a bat mitzvah student, I always say to them, they're going to face great changes in life, and they're going to have to choose what kind of person they're going to be. And it's very important that they become good, upright citizens, and that they not make the wrong choices. So I think the most important thing in life is to grow up without going crazy, to grow up without going crazy, without getting off the tracks. And that applies to all religions. As I recall, this was a two-part question. What did you ask in addition?
I was going to ask you that in your life, what do you wish you'd spent more time doing and perhaps less time doing?
I have no regrets about the choices that I have made. I wish that... I have to tell you, I love to teach. Well, the rabbinate gives me the opportunity to teach young people, and I think I've taught well. Of course, all of us think that we've been brilliant teachers, but... I really have. No, cut that, please.
Well, why? What's wrong?
All right, keep it in. On the whole, I think I've done what I want to do.
Rabbi Morton Hoffman, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for letting me have the opportunity to speak to a wider audience.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you, Melissa. What a great show, eh? That's our broadcast for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, tune in. Scott Westerman of the MSU Alumni Association will be in this chair. Also, we'll hear from Promised Land author Jessica Lamb Shapiro and a local band, live music in the studio, the Barred Owls. That and more tomorrow right here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Jolis Stroth is the producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also, Aaron Young for engineering, punching all the dials, and Libby Lusenhop for production assistance. I'm Tim Skubick. You've been listening to Current State right here on WKAR.